Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Tom Haberstroh, what is your favorite 80s food?
Kevin, I was 3 years old in 1989, so
Gerber's,
rice and beans, Kevin. That's my favorite 80s food trend.
Tom, you missed a beautiful world of Creole spice, blackened fish, and angel hair pasta in the lunch pasta salad and pesto and fajitas for everyone. Too bad you weren't around to do that. Tom, this is Pack Your Knives. I'm Kevin Arnovitz.
And I'm Tom Haberstroh.
Tom, we are at the end of Los Angeles. We are propelled into the final five this week. I want to take stock of the season. How did we get here? Big week. The final five is set. Opening thoughts about the field.
The regular season is over, Kevin. As we suspected, Voltaggio's there, Gregory's there, Melissa's there, Kevin Gillespie is there, and Stephanie, I think it's the big surprise of the season. Stephanie has made it this far, not because she's not a great chef, but because she didn't really have a strong entrance for the first several episodes of the show. And here she is going to Italy and really coming on strong. I feel bad for Malarkey because, you know, he seemed to get a little bit job there with the service. But as Tom Colicchio said, look, it wasn't about that. It was the food. It was the duo. And he had a little bit of a redemption tour halfway through the season as well. And so I was sad to see him go. He's a great character. Maybe they can bring him back in Italy like they did last season in Macau. It was one of those things where I think they kind of bring a group of chefs over to the finale.
Yeah, so you got to do like the sous chef business. In the finale, there's always like you get to pick your sous chefs.
I'm going to miss Malarkey. I'm gonna be honest. He's a character. I wish Eric, of course, I believe he was my third draft pick. I wish he was around. But I really think, Kevin, this is the postseason we wanted.
This is the field. It's very interesting. I mean, we obviously have some favorites. Stephanie has emerged as, I think, everybody's favorite underdog. What's interesting, if I can play arbitrary endpoint for a few minutes, Tom.
Yeah. Oh, I'm always
game. Who is the leading chef over the last 3 weeks in our point system?
I'm going to say Melissa.
No, Stephanie. And I'll go further. Who is the leading chef over the last 4 weeks?
Melissa.
Stephanie.
Whew.
Two wins. She got a five. She got the close second this week. She, I think, won the 2 weeks ago. I think she won her first quick fire. So Tom, she is the underdog, I think, and this is not to slight her. I think her personal chef portfolio versus, say, these prolific restaurateurs puts her as somewhat of a disadvantage. I think we've noted that she may not be as creative. She's a chef that needs some parameters to start with rather than just a creative chef who with a blank canvas will just come up with something beautiful. But she has achieved competence. I think there are shades of Adrian from a few seasons ago where the first two-thirds of the season were about building confidence. And then once that confidence was instilled, look out. Because I just love that we have an underdog. I love that we have an underdog in the field. By the way, what do we make of Final Five? It used to be Final Four. Am I correct?
I thought so, too. I'd have to go back and check that. It is a larger field. Maybe that has to do with the Last Chance Kitchen returning. But that doesn't make too much sense. Maybe they're just cutting one episode. I don't know. I was a little nervous, and we'll get to this later. I was a little nervous with Gregory there at the final stage because I really was hoping that Gregory was going to make it to the finale. I need to see Gregory at least have a chance to winning this competition. And it was the same kind of feeling that I had with Melissa a few weeks ago at the dinner with the moms at the Mountain Getaway, the Wet Hot American Summer Challenge. I thought that Melissa might have been going home just the same way that Gregory without the prosciutto was going home. But I'm so happy to see that we have Gregory, Voltaggio, Melissa, Stephanie, and Kevin going forward.
Yeah, I mean, Gregory's had a rough couple of weeks, right? I mean, he had the kind of under-seasoned rice dish and the Kaiseki Challenge. You know, I thought that quick fire, the coconut milk chocolate curd that was just beige more than anything. Forgot his prosciutto crisps. We'll talk a little bit about that in a few minutes. So he's had a bumpy few weeks. I mean, I think the change of scenery will certainly bring him back to the top, toward the top. But it's a really interesting field. I mean, it's got it stacked. It really is. I think you could make an argument for four of the five chefs. I mean, even Voltaggio, who, you know, has had, I think, a very regular season. I think the parallel you drew a few weeks ago is sort of a LeBron Cavaliers team. You know, the switch is going to be flipped at some point, but until it's pretty dark until that switch is flipped.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's, I think, cooked more interesting food in the last few weeks. And again, I've always said that I think as we get deeper into the competition and those, the goofy parameter, hey, cook upside down, blindfolded, you know, sort of stuff gives way to, hey, here's some time to create something with fewer parameters. I think he's going to be a very tough customer. Melissa is just magic right now. I mean, she's back on track. Whatever throat clearing happened a few weeks ago, she is back. And of course, as you said, Gregory, who I think was our first pick, was your first pick.
And right now he's number one in points.
Right, number one in points. I think he was the morning line favorite for much of the competition. And then, of course, Stephanie. So, I mean, hey, I'm telling you, the facts are the facts. In the past month, she has essentially been the if you go by scoring, the top chef.
Yeah.
So we'll start with I think probably one of your favorite and my favorite quick fire challenges ever. Make some airplane food.
And have champagne Padma. That was
By the way, she was drunk. She was drunk. It was hilarious.
She was shit-faced. I mean, she was
totally,
totally, totally bombed. I mean,
she looked like Allison and Eric, Eric in Lexington.
Yes, yes. We for those who don't know, we went to Restaurant Wars a couple of years ago. Was it last year? It was 2 years
ago? No, it was 2 years ago.
We drove over to Lexington from Louisville, which is about an hour-ish drive. And when we got there, they just served us drinks to wait and wait and wait when we got to Restaurant Wars in the airplane hangar or whatever it was that we went to. And we had to wait so long that they just gave us a bottle of wine. They gave, I think, of a bottle of rosé. They just were like, straight up, here you go. We're so sorry for the delay. And we were, you know what? We had way more fun. And I think Padma, this was her biggest performance of the season so far. And I think everyone, when you're on Top Chef and Last Chance Kitchen, I feel like everyone who's guest judging should have just a couple drinks in there to just get the emotions going. Because in the Last Chance Kitchen, when you saw the peanut gallery, like, I kind of felt like you got to give them just a few drinks before we get out there on the stage. And this one, she and Jonathan Waxman just were halfway in the bag.
It was fun.
It was great. I mean,
it was truly hilarious.
Were you excited to see the airline challenge? Because I felt like you must have just perked up a little bit on this one, huh?
I mean, look, one of my great sort of completest goals is to kind of – like I have two out of the three Gulf carriers in my pocket now. I want to experience all the leading international airlines because – you know, we're fortunate enough to travel so much for work, and I'm one of those, like, kind of George Clooney and up in the air points whores that I have just a ton of points. So I spend them largely on international first class and business class tickets. So it's not like I'm fancy pants. I just trade in on my travel that's where I spend those points. And so I've been treated to, like, I mean, one of the great experiences, sort of consumer experiences of my life was getting to fly Etihad Airways home, one of the longest flights in the world, Abu Dhabi to LAX, 16 hours. Oh. And I was in first class, not even business, first class. And the chef comes over. There's like a chef.
What?
Comes over and basically, you know, 2 or 3 hours in a flight says, let's design your tasting menu.
What?
And just kind of came over with a pad and sort of all these choices and asked what kind of food I generally gravitate to and what kind of flavors. And they put together, I kid you not, Tom, like a 6-course meal, Middle Eastern flavors. Like, it was one of the coolest culinary experiences. I mean, look, I don't know that the food was delicious. I don't know that it was like one of the 10 best meals I've ever had. But when you include context and just environment. And I was in one of these like suites where like it was truly like a room to myself. Wow. It was unbelievable. And it was just like – so I really kind of made a point to try to sample as many of the great airline meals. Like, you know, Emirates was nothing to slouch at. I've had great experiences on Singapore Air. El Italia, for all of its issues, has great food, as you might imagine. So this was such a thrill. Like, Tom, I got off on this challenge. This was so fun.
Oh, yeah. And the whole hype factor. So I guess, you know, when Tom Colicchio – by the way, if you haven't listened to the episode, we had an interview with Tom Colicchio. It was awesome. One of the things he mentioned when we gave him his pitch, where we delivered our pitch to him, he was like, what's the challenge? If my producer's in my ear saying, what's the challenge, guys? And in this sense – it's not just, hey, put it on a tray. It can't be too tall, right? And so that's one of the elements that Kevin Gillespie screwed up on, which he shouldn't have screwed up on because his grandfather is an airline executive, Kevin. We need to know more about this. You think he's Delta because he's Atlanta?
I would imagine it's Delta Airlines since he is an Atlanta guy. And by the way, that is one of the great privileges, like when you have a high level, you know, management or above executive for an airline, you go business and first all the time.
Oh, man.
You know, it was sort of interesting, and I thought Voltaggio had a good point, and basically Melissa followed this rule, Kevin to some extent, and Gregory, which is you want something braised, because one of the problems, like I'm a guy who always order fish at a decent restaurant if there's an alternative there that draws me. But the problem is you can dry stuff out. Like, you need the great thing about braising is, like, it's hard to overdo it. It only, you know, if you just kind of, because a slow roast in general is just, you know, retains its moisture. So
yeah.
I thought that was very smart. He did the braised chicken thighs. Kevin did, you know, a lamb meatball, which, you know, I mean, not exactly braised, of course, but the gram masala chicken from Gregory. And then you had, of course, the curry, beef curry, mushroom, and coconut rice. I mean, Melissa kind of wins on, you don't want to make it too cute for the airplane. You just want something savory. You know, if coconut rice, it'll stand up. Tofu salad, I was a little skeptical because I think, like, is the world into tofu yet? I mean, is that something that most people kind of look, you know, you unveil the little dish and it's like, tofu salad? I mean, that was the only question. Like, I was imagining one of the judges saying, hey, you know, in Top Chef, of course, a tofu salad makes a ton of sense. That, is that a crowd pleaser? Is there a lot of people who can press that little spongy substance and say, what the hell is this?
Is this ignorant to say that outside of vegetarians, does anyone like tofu? Like,
no, I do.
I'm saying, if you had a choice between meats and a tofu dish, I'm not sure you're choosing the tofu over that.
Right. But I mean, the one thing I've really discovered, you know, I think in like the 80s and 90s when it was purely like sort of the province of, you know, crunchy health food types, like tofu in this country has come a long way. Like a beautiful, clean, like a Japanese restaurant that makes their own tofu. That place in Vegas we like. What's that place called? I forget. God, it's escaping me. Oh, Aburiya Raku. Like, they do a beautiful homemade tofu. I love, like, going to the Chinese restaurant. You get, like, that sticky tofu. Not the mapo, but the stuff that sort of almost has the texture of eggplant. That's just really, really good. So I think that it's come a long way. But I just think that there's a large population of people who will look at a tofu appetizer. And I really thought she was going to get dinged for that. But I guess it was so delicious with the yuzu and the cucumber, especially against the savoriness of the beef curry, that it just worked. And
yeah,
I mean, her food's just so damn good right now.
It is. And I want to take a detour real quick on this because, Kevin, I'm sure you're an avid reader or at least familiar with thepointsguy.com.
Oh, of course. I mean, Ben is a guy who I will, is Ben pointsguy.com?
What you need to know,
or is that Gary Leff?
There is a long post about the science of airplane food written by Michael Y. Park
on that website.
Okay, so I read it and there's this one little section here that I think bears repeating it for this episode because it's so interesting to me. You mentioned how it dries out on the flights, and I think it's something we have to keep in mind when we're evaluating this challenge. Here's what not to put on an airline menu. Chefs have also learned to avoid certain pitfalls and problem foods when they're designing airline menus. Bread goes stale fast at altitude, and unless it's a necessary part of a sandwich, airline chefs generally try to serve bread only when it's just out of the oven. You'll rarely find French fries on an airplane menu because fried foods become impossibly mushy. Mineral heavy wines taste less like slate and more like plain old dirt among the clouds. And that's why onboard wine lists favor sweeter, fruitier options. Cruciferous, is that the pronunciation? Cruciferous vegetables, such as broccoli, give off an unpleasant odor as they're reheated, which is relatively minor detail.
It does. It smells like a fart. It
totally when you open does. A window. But another thing when you're seated in a sealed aluminum tube with 400 other people. And speaking of unpleasant gases, cruciferous veggies and beans tend to make people flatulent, which no one wants. So you'll generally see them used in moderation, if at all, in airline meals. Still, even with everything airlines have learned, there can be missteps. Taking perhaps the wrong lesson from the Spence study that said in altitude, you have a greater sense of umami levels. Virgin Australia served passengers on its Perth to Adelaide route Parmesan sandwiches on Christmas Day last year, thinking that the cheese's inherent savoriness would be an extraordinary treat in the air. But unfortunately, the odor from the cheese, which one witness described as, quote, old socks, quickly filled the cabin and made passengers who didn't order the sandwiches gag and vomit. Quote, it was sweaty socks. Their brains were telling them that they were smelling not pressed Parmesan sandwiches, Spence says. So, Kevin, what is the worst airline meal or something that you just cannot have on a flight that just irritates you when people open it, whether it was prepackaged going on to the flight or just something that filled the cabin air that you remember or something that just bothers you over the years? Fish, I mean, reheated fish, they can't be serving that.
No, I mean, there's a lot of good fish on airplanes. I mean, when people bring on next to you, hey, look, man, I'm somebody who appreciates a good pastrami or corned beef sandwich, but don't open that shit on the plane if you're sitting in like economy or whatever. Like, that's just gross. Like, I have to say something. As much as I love food and I understand they don't feed you on these flights anymore, but I just don't want your, like, at 7:30 in the morning, I don't want your smelly bacon biscuit.
Yeah, like, I know.
You're doing the crumbs on my, and it, you know, it's just like, come on. I mean, look, it's a free country, but it's just, I don't like overly smoky meats, even though I love, you know, typically love smoky meats. It's just, yeah, I wish people would exercise a little more restraint in the cabin, just a little more. No.
Like sometimes there's a Bojangles here in Charlotte Airport, and a lot of people like get their breakfast sandwich, Bojangles, to bring out their Cajun filet biscuit, which is delicious. Oh, it's really amazing.
I mean, we have had the Bojangles conversation on this podcast. Yes. Yes.
So, you know, they wrap it in that like kind of aluminum foil type wrap, and then you bring it onto the plane, and then when you open that up, that thing is like filling up the entire cabin with that Cajun filet biscuit smell, which in an open room, like outside, you're not really sensing that smell too much. But when you're inside of a cabin, it can really, really incapacitate some people. So I hear that. And I think in this episode with Top Chef, I did like that they penalized Kevin for his meatballs being over the size of the tray. I don't know if I like the bread that they give you on airplanes, but I do know that I like the butter they bring it with. I find that I don't really put butter on bread very often until I'm on a flight. I'm throwing so much salt on my food, like when they give those little pepper and salt shakers that are so adorable. I just use every condiment on my plate. I don't know about you.
All right. Yeah, one weakness to that point I have on planes, like a bad plane food that I actually enjoy, is like those croissants, those spongy kind of not great croissants that they give you in the morning on, like, you know, right before you land on an international flight, particularly, and sometimes on a breakfast flight if you're in business, like, and they're objectively not good croissants. I mean, we know what a good croissant, but like there's something about that sponginess, and it's always cold and it shouldn't be.
Yes.
And I love just to, like, I don't even use the knife for the butter. I just stick like it's a spongy croissant, like just kind of pick it up almost like in Jiro with Ethiopian food. Like I actually just kind of use the croissant as a pincher to just take the butter and just squish it.
Yes.
That is one of my gross, I cannot defend it culinarily, favorite things on like bad airline food.
You know what's also weird? In this study that they did, the science of airplane food, is when you're at altitude, you lose a lot of your sense of salt and sweetness. So they kind of jack it up a little bit on the food. They also dry out a lot. Of course, you mentioned that earlier. So they like to lather things with like barbecue sauces, and they usually cook them with, you know, a gravy or some sort of base to keep the moisture up. And I another thing I do on flights that, Kevin, I don't understand why, I always crave tomato juice. I don't know what it – maybe it is that saltiness. I don't know what
it
is.
Even better, Tom, than tomato juice is Mr. and Mrs. T Bloody Mary mix. With a little spice.
Yeah. And I never order that in real life. Like, I'm not going to lunch. If I go to lunch somewhere, I usually just get water or tea or something like that. But when I'm on a flight, I always crave the tomato juice. I always get the V8 or whatever it is, and I don't know what it is. Why is that?
I don't know, but I totally understand, because – and I feel ridiculous ordering a Virgin Mary, because like I don't love to drink alcohol on a flight. Look, I love good wine. It totally screws my head. It makes me feel nauseated. But like I feel ridiculous, and I won't even do it if there's someone next to me. But like
the shame,
I
love – like Virgin
I've always
Mary?
Loved Mr. and Mrs. T Bloody. It's like my favorite processed food is Mr. – my Aunt Shirley in Charleston, South Carolina – as a little kid, like I spent a lot of time at her house, and she always had Mr. and Mrs. T Bloody Mary mix, and she knew I loved it. She always kept it in the fridge, and it was in that little can, that Hawaiian Punch high C can, where you have to do the two little like little triangles on the sides. I think you grew up in a different era, but like we just had a lot of like fluids in these big aluminum cans. I mean, these oversized aluminum cans. I mean, they were nasty, but that was sort of my thing as a kid, and I still love it on a plane. Because it's one of the few places you can get it, right? Like, yep. You can I'm not going to – I just feel totally weird at a bar ordering a Virgin Mary.
Of course.
But, like, Bloody Marys are good.
Yeah.
And that – anyway.
So, wait. Yeah. I want to – just one more thing here, and this is a good transition back to the Top Chef episode. Did you know about this Chef Conclave?
Hello, listener. Guess who's back? It's me, Anthony Mays, your favorite butcher turned podcast producer, and I'm here to talk to you about – ButcherBox. ButcherBox is the most convenient way to get high-quality meat and seafood that you can trust delivered straight to your doorstep, free shipping, vacuum-sealed packaging. It's ready to go right then. It's ready to pop in the freezer. You get exclusive member deals and a variety of high-quality cuts at an amazing value. Going to the grocery store can be a huge pain. You're usually in a rush at an inconvenient time. You're waiting in line at the meat counter. You're taking a number. Maybe this place doesn't have a number. You're jostling with fellow customers. You're trying to get that ribeye that you want or that nice piece of salmon. Maybe the butcher that you're dealing with has a bad attitude or something. I don't know. That was never me, I promise. But maybe it happens. ButcherBox takes all of that out of the picture. You are always prepared with meat and seafood in the freezer, and you're not going to find quality for this price anywhere else other than ButcherBox. So sign up at butcherbox.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S, and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. You can choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/dings and use code DINGS, D-I-N-G-S, to choose your free for a year offer plus get $20 off your first order. Hello, listener. I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that we at Cinephobe love our pets. Zach and Boogie are inseparable. I've got two cats and a dog, and Amin is giving his best ass-on performance to convince dog owners that he loves their pet.
Hey, little, hey, boy, how you doing? And Noodle's just like, yeah, whatever.
Which is why today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. For many pet parents, summer is all about making travel plans like adventuring through the national parks, visiting pet-friendly beaches, or road tripping across the country. Wherever your journeys take you and your furry friend, you can help protect them along the way with the plan from ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
The American Airlines chef conclave that Waxman had been part of with Alice Waters and with Wolfgang Puck. Did you catch that on the episode?
No. What are they talking about?
So Jonathan Waxman was like, yes, as part of this quick fire, I was part of the 1988 American Air. Well, he didn't name drop American Airlines on this, but apparently there was a thing called the Chef Conclave. And it was a group of not celebrity chefs, because there weren't celebrity chefs back then, but it was notable chefs, that high profile chefs that American Airlines hired to create their menus for their like international travel or long flights. And this dude, Jonathan Waxman, super famous chef, was part of this with Wolfgang Puck and Alice Waters back in 1988, Kevin. So
they were the pioneers, because this thing's been now it's totally commonplace. So when you get the little menu, in fact, you know who was a chef for a while, I believe on Delta, was our favorite Michelle Bernstein from Miami.
Oh, wow. Well,
I remember like it was right after I think our Miami jaunt, because I remember like, oh, this is cool. Michelle Bernstein's doing the food on Delta.
Mm.
I think it was Delta.
Well, I also found out that Leanne Wong, who's got her hand in everything apparently, is the executive chef for Hawaiian Air. So she didn't get to be on this episode, but maybe Leanne, that we know from Chef Jen Carroll, how much she's a part of the planning process and the culinary side of things and the stocking of food. Maybe she has her hand in this that we didn't quite understand, is that maybe Leanne Wong came up with this airline challenge, Quickfire. She didn't get to enjoy it herself as a contestant, but I really love this episode and I think it just from start to finish with drunk Padma. Again, yeah. Stephanie with the champagne Padma line. She is such a joy to have in these confessionals because she has just got everything. She's a great chef, but I think she's even better on the commentary.
Right. As I've said, I think in the previous episode that she wins my trapped in an elevator for 2 hours contest. Yeah. And I felt really bad because her papillon just like that parchment paper. And I felt terrible. I think it was probably a really good dish, if not for the papillon. Who else got dinged? Malarkey for his the pork chop that just was too tough. And then the middlers were Voltaggio and Greg. The elimination challenge was also pretty amazing. Because Michaels is like...
Tell me about Michaels.
All right. So like Michaels is what we would now call old school in Los Angeles. Like I can't even describe it. It feels like a place where like, I don't know, record executives in the early 80s. Like imagine David Geffen in a party of four does like California French. So Cal French, it was this notion that, hey, French food could be brightened by California produce. You can, because French food, I think everybody loves, but it's sort of heavy. And what if we lighten it up? And a way to lighten it up is sort of to incorporate these, you know, California. So you just ended up in 80s food is hilarious. I mean, I kind of mentioned my sort of all 80s food lineup, which was, I remember my mom getting really into blackened fish. And, you know, angel hair pasta, because like 80s, you're starting to get a little health conscious. You don't want like the thick lasagna, and angel hair is sort of light.
I grew up on angel hair pasta, by the way. My mom loved to make angel hair pasta.
Moms loved angel hair pasta. Like the lunch salad, like the idea, and particularly lunch pasta salad, like that was a big 80s thing. Like you started seeing pesto everywhere. Fajitas, like the Tex-Mex movement, like fajitas for everybody. It's not just a thing like that got introduced. And man, like the sizzling plate of fajitas, like all these Tex-Mex places. I remember there was a place in Atlanta I grew up with called Rio Bravo, owned and founded by this Jewish couple, obviously. And like we loved Rio Bravo. And we loved the fajitas and the chili con queso. And I just went like Tex-Mex. So 80s was sort of this, hey, the first introduction of, I feel like, culinary ambition. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. It just happens to be the decade I grew up in, but I just feel like food before that was just exactly what you would imagine, just kind of like what they used to eat on Mad Men.
So, yeah, that's what I felt like this episode was like a trip to the 70s, Mad Men style, where it was, with the airline boom in the 50s. I just felt like this was a real nostalgic trip down memory lane for the culinary world. And it seemed like what a cool little reunion at the table with this Michael's challenge. And it was, I thought Michael McCarty just seemed delightful. I thought he was a great, host for this whole entire thing. And I haven't been to Michael's in Santa Monica, but I imagine there's a couple places in Miami that are kind of like this. And I just wanted to go. It just seemed, what a cool place that was.
Yeah. I mean, I've been out here now 23 years, and I remember going with family friends who were staying. Like, it's a place where if your parents' friends come out to Los Angeles and take you out or something. And because it's like, I've never even been, had the urge to go. I mean, it's definitely old school. It's not a menu that today would really inspire me, but it's fun now that we're long enough into the foodie movement that you can actually say, haha, there are these 80s trends in food. Like that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
The big hair and the belts, kind of that we can look back at 80s fashion as well. But the idea that there are these dishes, so it was kind of fun to watch them reimagine. I thought Stephanie picked very smart for her, right? The pasta and scallops, because it's just an easy thing to recreate. And you could already see Gregory's apprehension when he was sort of, he was fifth or sixth last to choose. And the monkfish beet risotto with pancetta was just, you could already see he was having trouble reconfiguring the components.
Yeah, Melissa, by virtue of winning the quickfire, she got the first pick. She went with quail. Gillespie went with duck. Steph went with the angel hair and scallops. Voltaggio went with the lamb. Then Gregory went with monkfish and prosciutto. And Malarkey ended up with the veal sweetbreads.
Which he was excited about, but you could already see it was a dish that played to his worth habits.
Yeah.
Right. It encouraged the sprawling craziness because it was these two things and they could do two different things. And like, whereas you could see Stephanie, there's pasta and there is scallops, you know, and he would have been better served by that because it just, this notion there were two proteins was like, oh shit, malarkey is going to go malarkey. There's no, this is the most sprawling dish on the menu and he is the most sprawling chef and it is one of his, it is truly his Achilles heel. And you just saw it coming from a mile away.
Yeah. And I feel bad. I feel bad for him on the servers not serving the judges table. That seems like a nightmare, especially in the close quarters in that kitchen. It just seemed like a closet that they were working in and just seems so chaotic. And I want to feel bad for Malarkey on that level. But then, you know, doing a duo, the hit rate on that has got to be who's the first baseman for the Orioles now who bats 200 every year? Well, the Mendoza line is the classic line, but what's his whatever. The duo in Top Chef history is probably batting 175, right?
All right, because like, the only – can I say something? I can't believe like Eddie Murray is the only first baseman in the Baltimore Orioles who ever matters.
Well, this
I'm sorry. Like I guess like it's sacrilege to mention any Oriole first baseman other than Eddie Murray.
Wait, I feel like Rafi Palmeiro's on there too.
Yeah, I guess he was a Ranger. He wasn't really an
Oriole. I get that. Yeah. Okay. I'm going to have to Google this at some point. But anyway, so I feel like the duo is, if it's not risotto level, it is just right below risotto level. And I hope Lynn can do a study on this, is the success rate of a duo.
I also want to correct myself. It just dawned on me, like, Frank Robinson should qualify too. like maybe. I mean, it's a little before my time. Yeah, to your point, the problem with the duo is it gives you two chances to fuck up. Right. It's always the why give the judges if even if you nail one, the other is going to be you more ways to fail. What was interesting about it is with the exception of Gregory, I felt like this was the perfect elimination challenge headed into the finals because each of those other five chefs were exactly it was a perfect illustration and demonstration of who they are as chefs. Like Kevin, he didn't finish in the top two, but you know, he roasted duck and then did something classically Gillespie, right? Let's make the rice into a savory croquette, right? Like, let's create this other, like, beautiful, completely out of left field element to incorporate things you never thought could be incorporated that way. Let's just do a croquette. And I just thought that was wonderful. Like, you know, Stephanie, we talked about it. You know, she just created these simple components that she knew how to execute, and what came of it was just gorgeous. You know, Voltaggio, right? He took the lamb with the currants and, by the way, another classic 80s dish, Paleto galette with a little sheets looking like a flower. So he just Voltaggioized it, right? Roasted lamb is now gorgeously cut in this beautiful symmetrical circle, you know, a cab cassis sauce rather than that the thick currant. So let's thin it out and then turn the potato into a fondant, which I thought was a pastry. I guess that's like a potato pastry now because I always associated fondants with like pastry. But it was just Voltaggio-ish, right? And then Malarkey was to a fault Malarkey-ish. And then Melissa, bless her heart, like she's just going to take these components that are simple, yet when you look at the entire thing together, it is complex. She manages to achieve simplicity and complexity all at once. It is why she is on top right now. And I mean, not in our scoring system, but just I think she is the strongest chef right now in the competition. And it was a beautiful demonstration of all five finalist chefs of who they are.
Yeah. And Melissa, with the rare double win, she wins the quickfire, wins the elimination challenge, 13 points in our scoring system. And it's tough to make quail is not easy to cook. Quail can dry up real fast because it's not real fatty and there's not a lot of meat on that bone, literally. And so when you cook quail, you have a very slim margin for error. And so I think when you choose that at the top, got a little bit nervous on that level, but Melissa, anything she chooses, I can't doubt her because everything that she has chosen in the past, when she has had the ability to choose, she absolutely nails it. She executes to perfection. And I felt I want to talk about the Brooke Williamson horror story that she gave, where she, the only time that she had cried in a kitchen was when at that restaurant cooking the lamb dish when she got like a bazillion orders for lamb at all very different temperatures. And I just felt so – my heart broke for her in that moment because I was like, I'm getting stressed out just even thinking about that. What a murderer's row of just talent on this. You had Sang-yoon. You had Brooke Williamson. They mentioned Nancy Silverton came out of that kitchen. Mark Peel. He's kind of a guy that – I don't know if I would be able to know him. I mean, name his name. But when I see him on the TV, I'm like, oh, I know that guy. I've seen him on a bunch of TV shows. So Mark Peel, also from this Michaels, and then Roy Yamaguchi. So this was a really cool, almost a finale dinner experience. And I also caught – did you notice the people in the background? This was a very intimate – back patio. And when shit was going sideways with Malarkey, you could kind of sense the entire restaurant was watching this table. There wasn't a lot of seats. And so I felt like it was pressure cooker from start to finish with this elimination challenge, the tight kitchen, the fact that when you serve to the judges' table, everyone is watching. Whereas in other restaurant scenarios, it's not quite on top of you like that. So I thought this was a really cool challenge. I learned a lot about California cuisine, and I'm sad to see Malarkey go. But you know, when you give that little vignette, the little segment about, you know, FaceTiming with your kids on his twin's 9th birthday, it always seems ominous in those moments. And let's talk about Malarkey's little breakdown at judges' table. What did you think about that?
Going back to Mark Peel, a couple things. He is Nancy Silverton's ex-husband. And so he is, you know, was a partner in the La Brea Bakery and the Campanile, that whole complex that really is definitively kind of 2000-aughts Los Angeles as anything. He also lost money in the Madoff thing. I think both of them got totally screwed by Madoff, which is an interesting and just hellacious outcome. The Malarkey thing is interesting because so – like the truth of the matter is that whole the plates disappearing or going to the wrong table didn't affect him. And I sort of – it was a little bit of BS for him to kind of almost – it seemed like he was ascribing his failures during the challenge to that when actually the plates were already set. And so it wasn't like any – and they made it very clear, you are not judged on that. We are not going to dock you for that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also the whole kind of almost – I mean, it did speak to what Flam talked about, which is this is not a guy who needs the show, right? I mean, he's – I think as Padma or Tom said, he's worth probably more than both of us.
Yep.
And you could almost see it in his farewell where it's like, hey, I've had a nice run. I've kind of gotten what I needed to get out of this, which is a little – and apparently is, you know, some more FaceTime to really assert himself as somebody who could care. Look, I got to tell you, I might watch a Malarkey cooking show or a fun reality show. Like he's a character and has I mean, I imagine he's pretty entertaining. So you could almost sense that his farewell, what Padma even had to say, are you basically bowing out of the competition, was an expression of what Flam told us a few weeks ago, which is this is not a guy who needs this to win this competition to get himself on the map. He's not only on the map, like he holds the map. And so that wasn't surprising. And again, I mean, I think, you know, whatever problems Greg we had, I don't think anybody was watching the judges, you know, the two elimination chefs on the two chefs on the block and saying, oh, Gregory might go home. I mean, I think it was pretty clear that it was Malarkey's week to go home.
And I wanted to hit this because it is a huge pet peeve of mine when I'm playing cards with someone or a board game or anything. When it's a head to head moment, if you're playing chess or whatever it is, when your opponent quits or says, oh, I've gotten such bad cards today. Like I never get the good cards. You always get the good cards, and starts quitting, and you can see them start to kind of surrender. I hate that. It's a passive aggressive way to steal the sweetness and joy of being the victor in any sort of board game or card game. And that's what Gregory was talking about here is I don't like when he jumped in and said like, dude, no, I think you should, on your own merits, stand here and face the music and let's go down together. Let's go to judge's table. And he said it in his confessional. I did not want to go to Italy because you quit. I wanted to go there because I deserved to be there. And I think that was such a great moment from Gregory just to say that, because I hate when people do that, is when you're feeling like you're not going to win, you just steal any sort of joy or any sort of satisfaction that your opponent can get by just saying, I'm out, I quit, this is not fair, I'm just going to take my bag, my ball and go home. You didn't beat me, I just quit. That would have driven me crazy if I was Gregory. I'm glad he called him out on that.
It was Gregory's pretty assertive, and we saw it in the Restaurant Wars episode too. Like, he's a really affable, friendly guy when you get him in the side interviews, but you know he will stand up for himself. That fish is, I'm not going out in some fucking uncooked fish, he said, and he is not going out because Malarkey laid down. I mean, nobody likes, as you say, the person who takes his ball and goes home.
Yeah, and are you worried about Gregory?
No. I mean, look, I think we've seen that every chef of all the five finalists have had a dry period, right? Melissa did it a few weeks ago. Gregory's hit a little dry period. Voltaggio didn't do shit for like the first month and a half of the competition. You know, Stephanie didn't do shit the first month and a half of the competition. Gillespie went out, for crying out loud, and frankly hasn't dazzled, although he's put together some really strong dishes that haven't won in the last few weeks. But, you know, everyone's had their burp. And what's going to be fun is going to Italy. My understanding, and I think we know this from previous chefs, that there's quite a hiatus between the last week of the American site.
Yep.
And the first week. Like, I understand they go home and then it's later. So, you know, it's interesting in terms of momentum. And I do think this is a momentum show. And I think what we just talked about, how each chef has some bad stretches and gets into a slump, that it is very much a momentum show. But this will – there's a hiatus here.
That'd be great study. Is the point leader going into the finale more likely to win overall, or is it just a free for all at that point? Does momentum in terms of just being the point leader after 11 episodes or 10 episodes, is that a greater indication of winning, or is it just totally random once you get to the finale? I'd imagine there is some correlation between how you perform for the first 11 episodes and then the finale. But who do you find yourself rooting for the most? Because all these contestants haven't won. And so Voltaggio might be the most decorated of the chefs.
Yet he is in fifth place right now among our five.
But he is trailing Stephanie, 37 points. Yeah. Stephanie has 39. Kevin Gillespie, KG, has 49. Melissa has 60. And Gigi, Gregory, has 63. So they've separated from the field a little bit, Gregory and Melissa. I think Kevin, probably points per game, is probably right there with them because he had to kind of go to Last Chance Kitchen for a while. But I find myself rooting for Melissa. And I don't know why. I just think she is I like Gregory. You know what? I don't know. Maybe I'm rooting for Gregory now that I think about it. Who would I be most upset if they didn't get to win Top Chef? And you know what? I'm going to change that. I'm going to say Gregory I would be most heartbroken about.
I mean, it sounds crazy. This is going to sound like a cop-out. Like, I really like all five of them for different reasons. Like, I like Stephanie because she's the underdog, and it's really nice to see someone the way I was sort of an Adrian stan in a couple seasons ago. I like Kevin because I love his food, and he's an Atlanta guy, so, you know, I have some solidarity there. I love Melissa because it's just like, again, like watching Steph, you know, in 2015. Like, she's just an amazing chef, and I really like her food. I love Voltaggio because the truth is I'm also a sucker for really elevated technical food. Like, I love going to a restaurant and eating that kind of food. Like, I love his plates. They're beautiful. And I love Gregory because, man, he just is a player. Like, he, you know, as I said, I mean, there, when he is on, man, he is on. He understands the competition. You know, he has the perfect combination, kind of like Melissa, of bringing, you know, like knowing what food to cook in what context, but also bringing a little bit of yourself to the competition. Yeah. Like, there is a personal expression. And so I'm really a fan of all five. I mean, on one hand, it's like, yeah, it's a cop-out. I'm not rooting for or against anybody. But on the other hand, I'm not going to be upset if any of these chefs win, because I just love the – I mean, maybe, okay, you know, Voltaggio's had his moment in the sun and whatever, but I love Voltaggio's food. I mean, come on. So I like all five, Tom. I'm kind of a softie.
I know. And Gregory is another reason why I really love Gregory. It's because even though he's a super competitor, he's also just genuinely really considerate of other chefs. And he's just so nice to everybody. And they seem to love him. You know, it's kind of like the LeBron versus Michael Jordan is who would you rather play with? And I'd rather play with LeBron. It just seems like he's just more fun because he's more of a team player, incorporating everybody else. And he passes you the ball. And that's one of his great gifts, is that he wants the teamwork. And I feel like Gregory is in the same way, where you see those moments with Nini earlier in the show and Steph. He just seems to be a real team player without being – you know, without losing some of his talent. And I think that's a really hard balance to strike, is not being too over the top, trying to help everybody with losing focus on your own dish. He just seems like someone who's the ultimate Top Chef competitor.
Yeah. I mean, I really, you know, he's so likable. Like, I love his manner and his, just even his use of language in these interviews. You know, it's just he kind of articulates the gestalt of the whole competition. I think this is cool. Like, you know, I really like the guy. So anyway, I mean, any closing thoughts? We're going off to Italy here, Tuscany, some of the cradle of Italian cuisine. It's going to be really fun just to watch him work. Any closing thoughts?
I love truffle. I'm such a sucker for truffle. I would love to go on a hunting trip for truffles, and it seems like they're about to embark on a hunt for truffles. It sounds really cool. I have never been to Tuscany. I've been to Rome. I've been to Florence. I've been to Cinque Terre. I have not been.
Well, if you've been to Florence, you've been to Tuscany.
I guess. Huh? Yeah, I guess.
You haven't done like the countryside.
No,
thing?
I haven't done the countryside thing. And so, any sort of crib sheet you can give me here on Tuscan food, or what are your things you're looking forward to about this trip?
I mean, it's just so
pasta
diverse.
and am I?
I mean, it's a little pasta, but there's definitely some kind of you know country cooking, and it's there's a certain rusticness to it. But I mean, it's going to be really fun. I'm also I love the field, as we've said a million times. I just like this fivesome.
Yeah, and I probably. This is a cop-out, but I think the points leader is the favorite at this point. I think Gregory is the favorite. The number one draft pick, it's pretty cool to say in a season of All-Stars, the number one draft pick coming into the competition is still, in my opinion, the favorite going into the finals. Although right there is Melissa just mowing people down.
Yeah, and I think what they have in common is they both know how to manage risk in a challenge and yet not sacrificing creativity. Anyway, so for Tom Haberstroh, this is Kevin Arnovitz, and this is Pack Your Knives.
Our kids have said to us since we moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.